open a book and it invites you to fall in.
That was my North Star. I always sailed towards that star.
Plan D, run away to Paris, live in a garret, get TB, drink absinthe, write deathless masterpieces and cough myself to death.
Welcome to the National Writer Series on Interlochen Public Radio. I'm Doug Stanton. Margaret Atwood says the hero of her new graphic novel got his superpowers in a very modern way.
If this had happened in the 40s, he would have become Angel Catbird by falling into a vat of chemicals. But since it is now the 21st century, of course he becomes Angel Catbird through a collision between a cat, a bird, himself, a car, and a vial of super CRISPR genetic super splicer.
Margaret Atwood is the author of many best-selling novels such as The Handmaid's Tale and Cat's Eye. Her latest books include Hagseed, which is a retelling of Shakespeare's play The Tempest, and Angel Catbird, a graphic novel featuring a catbird superhero. Margaret Atwood starts off telling me more about how she came to write Angel Catbird.
The weirdest one that you want to know about immediately is how come I, a person such as myself, who isn't 20 or even 30 or even 40 or even 50, we can go on, would end up writing a graphic novel, otherwise known as a comic book with hard covers. I did ask, you know, what's the difference? And they said, well, basically comic books are short and soft and graphic novels are longer and with hard covers.
Mm-hmm.
So here's how it came about. It is at its heart joined to a bird conservation project, which is something that we've been in for quite a long time. And there are four horse items of the apocalypse threatening birds. You notice that that was a general, gender-neutral locution. I didn't say horseman. Horse items.
Horse items.
Horse items of the apocalypse. Not horse women, either. Horse things. And they are habitat loss, poisoning, glass window strikes, and cats. And cats, in fact, do for a huge number of migratory birds, particularly every year. But you cannot, but you have to tiptoe around that issue because you know why. It is the death threats from the cat people. If you even suggest.
You just hands the phone and you just goes, do they pee on your, they come and pee in your car or something?
What, the cat people? No, they actually say, I will kill you. so you can't say to them, your cat is an evil monster and you must flush it down the toilet. You can't actually say that. And anyway, I don't believe it because I was a cat person and have been one for thousands of years. Before you were born, I was one. So what could be clearer than that the way to tackle this issue would be to create a flying superhero who is a blend of cat and bird plus human being and can therefore address both sides of this issue and have an identity conflict. So as it happens, I was drawing flying cats from the age of six or so. And I can prove it because there's going to be one in volume three of Angel Catbird, maybe even volume two. There's one in there. It's coming up. It's upcoming. One of my early flying cat birds. So I had this idea, but I didn't know how to. I do comics, but my comics are primitive.
Right. You drew them as a young, in the 40s.
No, I continue to draw them, and I draw them to this day, but they're quite basic.
Huh. What do you do with them? Do you put them in
a
notebook?
Well, the latest iteration of them is in a volume called The Secret Loves of Geek Girls, put together by Hope Nicholson. And I did some comics for her that she could put on her Kickstarter to raise money. So I did four panel strips for her, which ended up in The Secret Lives of Geek Girls. And what she wanted was autobiographical thing. So my comics are autobiographical.
What do you like about comics?
What do I like about them? I grew up in them. You know, it's like, it's just, they are a language like other artistic languages. And they're a way of telling stories with the aid of pictures. Many kinds of stories, a huge variety in the 40s and early 50s. I read them all. So I knew what I wanted my superhero to look like, but I couldn't draw it myself.
Right.
I wanted him to look like that guy on the cover, you know, very well drawn. How can I put this? Anatomically correct.
Is there a doll that you can purchase yet?
Not yet. No. Wait for it.
Wait for it. Okay.
So, and I wasn't in the world of young comic artists, but Hope Nicholson was. I'd helped her with her Kickstarter, got together with her in a bar where many things are discussed, and I said, what do you think of, how would you put together a comic about a flying cat, bird, human being? And because she was in comics, she's a comics entrepreneur, she didn't give me a weird look. She instead sent me some samples from a range of artists, and we picked Johnny Christmas, his real name, out of the lineup, and he's been wonderful.
Some of his work, it's extremely vivid, and I believe you call this a splash or something like
that? No, that one is splash page.
But do you think
this terminology now
satisfies in you the same impulse you had in the 60s when you began writing poems? Because this is somewhat image, it is imagistic, it's almost ideographic in a way. You're using the...
You mean comics?
Yeah, the comics.
It's a narrative art, which is also visual.
It's not lyric, necessarily.
No, but some people's comics are. Some people's comics are very lyric.
Do you have a favorite?
David Mack, extremely lyric. Wonderful artist, actually. He has a series called Kabuki. Gorgeous.
Okay.
But there's a huge range. At Comic-Con this year, I saw a lot of very odd comics.
What was that like? Walk us through... Going to the Comic-Con in San Diego.
Comic-Con, well, it's
you walk in the doors and what do you see?
People in outfits. Mm-hmm. You see quite a few people in outfits, some of which you will be able to identify and some of which you have no idea. But
what are you wearing?
This time?
Yeah.
This time I was understated. I had purchased three sets of ears at a place called Malabar's in Toronto.
Ah.
And I did persuade Johnny Christmas and my editor, David Chabon, who is the much younger brother of Michael the novelist.
Okay.
I did persuade them, it took a bit of doing, but I did persuade them to put on the ears and get their picture taken.
Were these the Star Trek ears? No.
These are cat ears.
Cat ears.
Please.
I'm glad I asked. You actually, you walked into the Comic-Con wearing cat ears.
No, we did that at the... We did that at the signing.
Uh-huh, interesting.
Yeah.
You have more fun, I think, than most authors on tour.
Yes, it's true. Yeah.
So that, was it exciting? Did you?
Okay, so I first went to Comic-Con 4 years before, and that was for Ray Bradbury. And we had all put together a book called Shadow Show, which was a tribute to Ray Bradbury and his work, and each one of us was to write a Bradbury-esque story. So I had a story in Shadow Show, and I was going to go to Comic-Con to help launch it, and he was going to be there. But then he got ill, so I changed my flight. So I was going to go to Los Angeles first and visit him. But then, just before I got there, unfortunately, he died. So I was there in Los Angeles with his biographer, who was a horror writer called Sam Weller. So I ended up going on a road trip to San Diego. So then we got there, and then I fell in with some I fell in with some people making a film. And this was going to be the first Iranian vampire Western film. So I got palsy with them, and they wanted me to be a perk on their Kickstarter to finish the film, because they needed to edit it. So I, nothing loath, I said I would be a perk on their Kickstarter. And the perk that I am can be seen in the film itself, which is actually quite good and has become a cult classic. It is called A Girl Walks Home Alone at Night, and it's the only time you'll ever see an Iranian vampire girl on a skateboard wearing a chador, wafting along at night. It's a very poetic shot. Anyway, she's more or less of a good vampire, but on the goodish side of being a vampire. And in her apartment where she lives, she's fond of music, is a poster that might look at first glance to be a Madonna poster, but in fact it is. It says Margaret. And in this poster, I'm a blonde.
Oh. And that's what happened to you on the way to Comic-Con.
That's what happened. This is a normal day in my life.
How do you get any work done?
That's a problem. Yeah.
Yeah.
Yes. Anyway, somehow it does get done. But I'm not always going to Comic-Con.
No, I know.
No.
You went to the University of Toronto.
I did.
And then you made your way to Radcliffe and Harvard.
Well, it was that moment in time. And the moment in time was people who were born when I was, which is 1939, so end of the Depression, not yet the baby boom. We actually were in a pretty privileged demographic slice because people realized they were going to need people who would service all of these baby boom kids who were coming along, and they didn't have enough of them. Mm-hmm. So people like the Woodrow Wilson Foundation, they were actively recruiting. They were actively recruiting people to be university teachers, etc. And our worry in the 50s was not, I will not be able to get a job. Everybody knew they were going to get a job. It was just a question of what job mm-hmm. will I get. So it was a very different sort of thing. And if they had not been actively recruiting, I would have gone to Plan D. Plan D was to run away to possibly England, or even better, Paris, live in a garret, get TB, smoke cigarettes, drink absinthe, write deathless masterpieces, and cough myself to death at an early age. It was the age when people actually did that, and or some version of it.
Wow.
So, I mean, they didn't do the coughing to death thing, but a lot of them went to
right.
England, particularly if they were interested in acting, they went there. If they were interested in writing, they might go to Paris or New York or London.
You were writing poems then, a lot of them.
Some... I was writing everything that I since have written, including the comics, but only the poems were getting published because of the difficulty of publishing novels in Canada at that time.
Okay.
So we were churning out little magazines in the cellar and on Mimeo machines, and I hand typeset my first book of poems on a flatbed press and made them into little books, which we actually went around to bookstores, they took them. We sold them for 50 cents. We were doing that kind of thing. But novels were long and expensive to produce, and Canadian publishers were prone to thinking that they couldn't publish your novel unless they had a co-publisher in the United States or England to share the costs. So a lot of people had novels accumulating while at the same time they were publishing poems.
Mm-hmm.
And people like Michael Ondaatje, same thing.
Mm-hmm.
And that was just the norm for us.
What do you think you write about today, given that What I'm hearing is the sky was the limit. I mean, you were...
No, the there wasn't a sky, which I think is what I'm talking
about. Right, well...
No, sure, it's the same thing in a way. There was a big blank space.
Right, that's what I mean.
Yeah, which you could either feel discouraged by.
You didn't feel discouraged, no.
I was kind of ignorant. Mm-hmm. I ought to have felt discouraged.
Yeah. Yeah, but you didn't.
No.
You know, I saw that, for those of you, I mean, you know, is it true that every day your mother would get up and take a swim in the bracing lake?
Yeah, that's true.
The bit I've learned is a heavy dose of self-reliance, almost this Emersonian kind of summer existence up in the woods, and you seem to be a very content person up there following your own voice. And I'm wondering what that voice, what you're hearing, because these books are so varied. You know, we want to talk about this, Hagseed, which is a retelling of The Tempest.
Yeah.
And then this.
Which is not a retelling
no.
of The Tempest.
But this fellow is entrapped by science in a sense of magic because of something that happens to him that turns him into the catbird.
Yeah, well, right? If you know your superheroes, you know that if this had happened in the 40s, he would have become Angel Catbird by falling into a vat of chemicals.
Yeah.
And if it happened in the 50s, he would have become Angel Catbird by being irradiated with atomic energy. But since it is now the 21st century, of course he becomes Angel Catbird through a collision between a cat, a bird, himself, a car, and a vial of super CRISPR genetic super splicer.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
As one would.
Which you can sell probably in the gift shop next to the doll.
Well,
you
know, they're working on this.
Yeah.
Maybe without the car accident.
But tell us about Hagseed.
Okay, so Hagseed. Hagseed is part of the Hogarth Shakespeare series, in which I think they're up to 8 people now, 8 writers of some renown. Who were approached with the idea that each one of them would write, would revisit a Shakespeare play of their own choosing in a modern novel. But apart from that, they didn't tell us anything. They didn't say it has to follow the play, or it just had to be connected in some way with the play. So we first got Jeanette Winterson, who did a novel called The Gap of Time, which is the mm-hmm. Winter's Tale. And she kept pretty closely. She has a something representing each of the characters and plot elements. And mm-hmm. I thought she did it very cleverly. Mm-hmm. Howard Jacobson did Merchant of Venice, and it's called Shylock Is My Name, and it is mostly about Shylock. So it doesn't so much follow the plot as the character. And Ann Tyler did Vinegar Girl, which is Taming of the Shrew, a very tall order in our day and age. Mm-hmm. But she makes it come out all right. And I chose The Tempest. And
you've long been a Shakespeare aficionado. You've gone to Stratford a lot.
Yeah, right? We had a lot of Shakespeare in high school. Mm-hmm. Not only did we have Shakespeare that we studied, but there was this group of leftover English, how shall I put it? They were from England and they were somehow in Canada. I'm not sure how they got there, but there they were. And they were called the Earl Grey Players. And they would go around to high schools and put on the play that was on the final exam that year. So of course they had a full house wherever they went of nervous students. And you could be in the chorus. You could be in Macbeth if you brought your own plaid car rug, and you could be in Julius Caesar if you brought a bed sheet. You could be in the mm-hmm. The crowd saying rubble, rubble, rubber, rubber, rubber. And they would put on these plays. So that was my first view of Shakespeare as the play. Stratford Shakespearean Festival was starting around that same time. Mm-hmm. And it has been in full swing ever since.
You do a pretty close retelling, kind of plot-wise,
Very clever.
Yeah. Well, The Tempest is the play above all plays, mm-hmm. which is it's the closest Shakespeare ever gets to writing about what he did all day, mm-hmm. which was putting on plays. So The Tempest itself is Prospero as director, behind the scenes, invisible as directors are, working with a very good special effects guy called Ariel, who puts on illusions, and by means of them, he manipulates the other characters in the play. And then there's a play within that play, which is the Mask of the Goddesses.
And you set your version in Hagseed in a...
I put it in something that is not quite the Stratford Shakespearean Festival. Exactly. For instance, the town of Stratford does not have a pub called the Imp and Pignut, but it will. Yeah,
really?
It is like that. And Felix has been the artistic director, and because he hasn't been paying attention to his second in command, Tony, he gets deposed all of a sudden and finds himself out in the parking lot with all his belongings in a cardboard box, as one does. Mm-hmm. So then he goes off to the version. The thing I could get that was close to being a secluded magic island, and then he gets a chance to revenge himself upon his enemies, which he does by putting on a production of The Tempest in the place where he has been teaching literacy through literature, a nearby correctional facility.
Mm-hmm. Exactly. I knew the car filled with a vampire was heading there in some way. And a little later I'll have you've been kind enough to say you'll read a piece from the novel.
I shall.
A little bit. So Felix.
Yes.
Prospero.
Yes.
Is Prospero's he's turned out by Antonio and left Milan and shipwrecked on this island for 12 years. And so it's very clever how this is all happening. And who's Ariel in your novel? He's the digital hacker guy, right?
Okay, yeah. So Felix, of course, has to cast his play. And he has been putting on plays. He first put on Julius Caesar, very direct, easy to understand, stabbings, wars, stuff easily graspable. And then he puts on Richard III, which is pretty good, except a few too many of the cast members are on the side of Richard. So people like, the people in the institution like these plays. There aren't very many women in them. And the women that are in them, they don't actually mind playing them because they're either witches or evil and old, or they're Lady Macbeth. But when it comes to The Tempest, he has a problem. He has to talk them into it. At first, they don't want to do it because there's a fairy in it. Nobody wants to play the fairy. So he has to really...
You mean Ariel?
Yeah. Ariel flies around, is invisible, sucks flowers. It's not something they want to be. So he has to talk them around Ariel. And he gets them to re-visualize Ariel as an alien, which is much more acceptable than a fairy. Mm-hmm. And when they realize that Ariel is the special effects guy, and that means that everybody on his team is going to get to fool around with computers, that's a big incentive. Mm-hmm. So he's able to cast Ariel. The other character has trouble with is casting Miranda, a 15-year-old girl. None of these guys wants to play a 15-year-old girl, nor would they be convincing. Mm-hmm. So he hires an actress to come in and do it. He talks her into it. And her name is Anne Marie, and it helps that she's a choreographer and extremely fit, and vigorous dancer.
And they've worked together.
He and Anne-Marie have, yes, back before he was deposed. So the thing about Prospero in the play is it's his own fault that he ended up on that island. He immersed himself in magic studies instead of paying attention to being the Duke of Milan. And Shakespeare certainly took that view. And it's in Prospero's account of himself. It doesn't make him feel any less vengeful.
Right.
But he does know that it's partly his fault.
You're listening to the National Writers Series from IPR News Radio. Coming up in the second half, more of Doug Stanton's conversation with Margaret Atwood.
Listening to the National Writer Series from Interlochen Public Radio. I'm Doug Stanton, founder of the year-long book festival held in historic City Opera House in Traverse City, Michigan. Let's return to my conversation with Margaret Atwood. I wanted to talk about the sense of prison or imprisonment and really go, and it'll bring us to today to talk about Handmaid's Tale, because it seems more prescient than ever.
Would that it were not so.
Published in 1985, and if you haven't read this amazing novel, do so among the others. I reread it recently. Tell us what that book is about and how you feel today looking back on it as it speaks to our society.
Okay, so back in those days when I began writing it in West Berlin before the fall of the wall, so I think I was interested in three sets of things. Number one was Puritan New England, which was not a democracy. It was a theocracy.
Mm-hmm.
Number two, having read so many utopias, dystopias, etc., in my life, and some of them as a teenager, I'd always sneakingly wanted to write one, but they were mostly written from the point of view of men, so I was wondered how that would be if you turned it around and wrote it from the point of view of a woman. I'd always been pretty interested in totalitarianisms and how they work. So I was interested in the answer to the question, what would a totalitarianism be like in the United States today, if there were to be one? What kind of totalitarianism would it be?
This is 1985.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. 1985, we were beginning to see the stirrings of the kind of cultural divide and right-wing politics that we have seen recently today, but they were more incipient. You know, they weren't really, they had not really achieved a lot of mm-hmm. political power at that time. So the answer to the question, what would a totalitarianism look like if we had one today? The answer would not be it would be communist. I don't think that would have any takers. And you need at least 30% of people on your side to get a really good totalitarianism going.
You know, is that like a rule?
It's just about like a rule. Consult the experts.
Wow.
You need a certain number of people willing to go along with you and see the beauty of it and realize that they themselves can benefit if they have positions of power within this thing. So what would it be like? I used to think that it would not be in order to protect liberal democracy, we have to take away a lot of your rights and privileges.
Mm-hmm.
But I'm not so sure about that anymore either. We're doing this for your own safety, mm-hmm. etc. We've heard it before.
Mm-hmm.
So it would be much more likely to have some kind of religious facade. Mm-hmm. And whatever these things are, when they get going, it's always ever only a facade. So,
well, it's another sense of using magic, right, to imprison someone.
What you mean? You mean the images and rhetoric?
Yeah.
Oh, sure. Yeah. So that's why I wanted to write it, but I also didn't want to put anything into it that people had not done.
Right.
At some time, in some place. In other words, I didn't want anyone saying, this all comes out of your dark, twisted imagination, and people would never do this.
What do you mean by that, though? Do you mean that they would go to a grocery store in this novel, which they do, in The Handmaid's Tale, they go shopping?
No, I mean that the kinds of things that we find difficult, or I hope we find difficult in the book, such as the bodies hanging on walls, and even the people pulling on the rope in the group hanging, and people controlled by what they wear,
mm-hmm.
People being forbidden to read, all of these things have happened.
And I see what you're saying, because we have hung people, we have banned books, we have control people through their clothing. And this is happening in it's happening in somewhat in the future, but not really futuristically.
Well, in 1985, I was writing about a future that was maybe 20 years along from there. But we've already passed that point.
Mm-hmm.
So it's not on another planet. It's not in a right. galaxy far, far away and in another time. It is on this planet, and we have all of the technology to do such a thing, and we also have done all of the things that are in the book. So it's not outside the realm of human nature that people would behave that way.
For the audience, the character, the female protagonist is how do you pronounce her name?
You can't make me pronounce the names of stuff I write. It's not fair.
We want to hear it from the master.
Okay, Offred.
Yeah. Offred. So she is the object of the preposition, always.
Yeah, so I made all the names of the people in the book. They're actually like Mrs. This and Mrs. That, and they're like some other languages that have suffixes and prefixes
right.
attached. So it's just like that.
Tell us. The premise of the book is the world has ended. It's so toxic.
No, only the United States.
Okay.
Yeah. So Canada's still okay, and you can still and you can still escape to it, as people have done over time for quite a long time.
So Canada's there, and it's happening in Boston, essentially.
Okay. So yeah, not all of the United States has yet. Come under the control of this regime, so it's at war with parts of itself. New York is holding out, as it would. But I set my book in Cambridge, Massachusetts, home of Harvard, which began life as a theological seminary in the 17th century,
mm-hmm.
and now fancies itself as a bastion of liberal democracy.
Mm-hmm.
When I first published this book, Harvard was quite sniffy about it. They didn't like it that I'd strung bodies up on the Harvard wall and that they made Widener Library into the home of the Secret Service. So they were sniffy, but they've come around.
Mm-hmm.
They've come around over time.
Mm-hmm.
So I set it there, and all of the buildings in the book are real except one of them that's been torn down since, but for instance, the Brattle Theater is in there, and the Widener Library, and they're mm-hmm. recognizable. And that's what people found shocking, I think, at first, was that this place that was supposed to be so open and liberal and so on and so forth, that I'd made that the center of this oppressive totalitarianism.
Mm-hmm. How do you respond to the idea that it's a feminist book or a feminist?
Well, what do we mean by that word? It's always the question. Do we mean you have to wear boots and overalls and kick men off cliffs, or do we mean women are human beings? Mm-hmm. If the latter, I put my hand up.
Mm-hmm. Right.
But it is really a, it's a book about totalitarianism. You'll notice that the men on the lower echelons of society aren't faring so well either. So it's only the top levels that get de facto polygamy. The men on the lower layers have to deal with only econo-wives, and the econo-wives have to do all these functions. The housekeeping, the,
wow.
The kids. The
right. The description, so only certain women can have children.
Yeah.
So, and these.
So the other premise is that when things are rare and valued, people on the top layers of society get more of them. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. It certainly happened in Nazi Germany, and it happened in Russia. And as we're stealing other people's children, that is an old motif. Mm-hmm. So Hitler actually stole Polish children, blonde ones, and placed them with German families, hoping that they would grow up into Germans. Didn't exactly happen, but that was his idea. Mm-hmm. And he also had for the SS, he had Lebensborn mm-hmm. enclaves where you could have, quotes, biological wives. So all of this has gone on. Child stealing also was big in Argentina under the generals, as you know.
Sure, and the Despiciados.
Exactly. And forced childbirth, that was Ceausescu in Romania. Mm-hmm. So these things, they're motifs. Mm-hmm. And it is a feature of totalitarianisms that they interest themselves in those kinds of things. They get very interested in women's bodies, who gets to control them, who gets more of them, and those sorts of things.
What, in 1983, when you're, this is just, you know, this is bubbling in your psyche, what, where's it coming from, this story?
It's coming from 17th century New England, totalitarianism, sci-fi, and dystopias, and the political statements being made by people at that time. Mm-hmm. And I am one of those people who does not believe it could never happen here. I just have never believed that. I think that anything can happen anywhere given the circumstances. Mm-hmm. And people were saying at that time women's places in the home. Mm-hmm. In fact, some women made quite lucrative careers out of saying that.
What am I missing? Who?
Oh.
Okay, yeah.
Among others. Yeah, Phyllis Schlafly, among others, did quite well out of it.
Right. And Anita Bryant.
Exactly. Lots of examples. Mm-hmm. So all very well. If women's place is in the home, having let them out of the box, how do we stuff them back in? Mm-hmm. Yes. Yeah, so that is what is going on.
So having studied the 19th century novel at Radcliffe and Harvard, you end up writing a novel and studying how that 19th engages society, how it attempts to change society, how you come full circle. I mean, what story should we be writing today?
Story should we be writing today? Woo. First of all, you can't tell writers should. You can't tell them what to write.
Tom Wolfe did, though, in his famous essay, The Billion-Footed Beast.
I know, but
don't agree with him?
No,
No.
No, you cannot. Once you start telling artists what they have to do, you're into, as far as I'm concerned, Stalin. You're mm-hmm. into Stalinism and Hitler's views on painting.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, so he thought that painting should be about bowls of flowers, heroic soldiers, inspiring mountain landscapes, happy children, dogs.
But can you tell them what not to write?
You can tell them. They won't pay any attention to you.
Well, but you've just given an award, the Pinter, I'm going to call it the Courage Award.
The English Pen Pinter Writer of Courage Award.
And you were friends with Harold Pinter, who wrote the screenplay to Handmaid's Tale.
I knew Harold Pinter, yes.
And tell us about that award, because you can tell writers not what to, but you do that in a very barbaric...
Oh, you try to kill them. Yeah.
You try to kill them.
Or you kill them. You try to kill them and you kill them.
So we're moving from The Handmaid's Tale and imprisonment, and I'm talking about censorship, essentially, I think. But let's go now to this award, because I think it comes back to this idea of power and the imagination to break through those.
So the thing about writing is, and languages, they are our oldest technologies.
Mm-hmm.
They're very old. Storytelling is way older than writing words down on a page. And words are very powerful, and the more totalitarian a society is, the more powerful words become, because to write something that challenges that totalitarianism has enormous resonance.
Mm-hmm.
And I know that from visiting Soviet Union countries when they were still Soviet Union countries,
mm-hmm.
and talking to people usually in the middle of a field about that.
Mm-hmm.
And that's when you get samizdat movements and manuscripts being passed from hand to hand, and methods of resistance amongst artists. So it is a very powerful thing. The Pen Writer of Courage Award is intended to honor, and there are similar ones with Pen America, by the way, honor people who have seen that dragon really up close.
Mm-hmm.
And sometimes the people chosen are in prison and they can't actually turn up to get the award. This time the writer did. He had survived a machete attack directed at him by right-wing religious fanatics in his own country, which is Bangladesh. And that was for writing, you know.
He wrote things.
Writing freely. He wrote things that those people didn't like.
So they tried to chop him up.
That's right. So one of the things, all joking aside, one of the things that has really quite alarmed me in the spectacle of this election was the kind of hostility directed at the press.
I agree.
You know, that is so typical. If you read the histories of totalitarian fascist types of movements, that is very typical. Suppress the press, suppress writing, don't allow people to speak.
Right.
So scary.
So you were first given an accolade, and then you were gracious enough to single out this person.
That is the way it works. It's always two.
Yeah,
for
two.
That award.
And then he will. This will provide him some cover, I hope, he thinks, for his own work, because he's now been given this award and announced. How is his machete attack different than Charlie Hebdo?
Well, he didn't die.
He didn't die.
Yeah, he was very lucky, as he says, but he has a big scar. He's deaf in one ear. He didn't come out of it.
What do you say to people?
The same way he went in, yeah.
After the Hebdo attacks, I had conversations with friends who said, well, what did they expect? You know, if you're going to do satire about people and pick on their religion.
This guy wasn't doing, Tutul was not doing satire.
Mm-hmm.
That's just it.
Right, so it's even worse in a way. I mean, they just picked on him because they didn't like it, what he was saying.
Well, Charlie Hebdo is the same. They didn't like that either.
Right. So how do you respond to that, though? I mean, what's the answer?
I think that in no way excuses, you know, what do you expect? It's a lot like what gets said to rape victims.
Right. So you're blaming the satirist for the
depiction.
People
who say that are in fact blaming the satirist and saying, oh, if you don't just sit down and shut up, nothing bad will happen to you.
Right.
That's not true either, by the way.
But I agree. No, I was somewhat shocked and irritated by the discussions I was having because, you just can't live your life. You can't be an artist that way. You can't allow the imagination to be prospero like if you're going to be living under the threat of the machete or the knife or the gun.
Well, oddly enough, some very interesting art has been created under conditions of censorship.
True.
I think the thing about writers and artists is they're quite often in the front lines when totalitarianisms get going, attempts at repression get going. First of all, because they do have a habit of not shutting up. And second, because they're always somewhat isolated figures. They don't belong to a great big army of writers with guns. You know, mm-hmm. You can sort of pick them off one by one.
I think one of the arguments for not doing the satirical depictions would be that you needed to be sensitive to that person's milieu or their culture, and so why would you make fun of it? It's not correct, and I'm wondering what you think about inhabiting other psyches and other voices in people's lives as an artist. If you think of your Shakespeare book, Hagseed and the Tempest, it's all about. I mean, Shakespeare inhabited all those characters when he had to create them. But now what I see sometimes in the public sphere is a pushback against that. You know what I mean?
I think what you're talking about is the appropriation of there voice conversation.
Right, okay.
Yeah, so the appropriation of voice conversation goes way back to the following situation. In indigenous cultures, stories are owned by a family, usually, or a group, and they are passed down like a table or a house or something like that. They're considered to be owned. Certain stories that are foundational, important stories are to be told by these people.
Mm-hmm.
And the appropriation of voice conversation came out of that. You know, don't come in and take our stories away from us and tell them yourself, because only we ought to be telling these stories. People then extended that quite broadly out, so that you shouldn't be speaking in the voice of anybody ultimately who wasn't you. And when we got to that point, it was reductionist to the extent that all you were then able to write would be autobiography,
mm-hmm.
and autobiography without any other people in it except you.
Mm-hmm.
Which is quite limiting.
Do you think in the realm of our artistic creation, some of us are there? I mean, some of that thinking is there?
No. No, I don't think so. Because you actually can't write an autobiography with nobody in it but you. You are the interactions you've had with other people. So when you think, what is a character in a book or a play? A character is what that character says about him or herself. It's what that character says to other people. It's what that character does. Mm-hmm. It's what other people say about that character.
Mm-hmm.
And it's all of those things. It doesn't exist in a little room minus everybody else, mm-hmm. unless it's being written by Samuel Beckett. But but even so, that those people in the rooms are jars with their heads sticking out. They have memories of other people.
Mm-hmm.
They do not exist in a vacuum. And we are social beings. You cannot bring a baby up apart from people. They will die.
Mm-hmm.
It's called failure to thrive.
Failure to thrive. What would you say to, I'm just thinking of this now, because I sometimes teach writing and work with younger students, and if I were to say to some of them, it's a female student, try to write this in the voice of a male character, they might not want to go there.
That would be their choice. But they're not wanting to go there. Is that because they think they can't, or because they think they're prohibited?
Prohibited. Because of this appropriation.
Yeah.
Tell
that to Madame Bovary. Yeah, the fact is that you actually cannot write a novel with only one person in it who has never known any other people.
If people were tweeting this conversation right now, we would start some type of Twitter war, and I know you're huge on Twitter, because these are, I think, kind of very current ideas that are floating.
Yeah, but I think they're current ideas that come from a misunderstanding.
Mm-hmm.
And the misunderstanding is that the original conversation was about something quite different.
Right.
It was not saying you cannot ever speak in the voice of anybody who isn't you.
Mm-hmm.
It was a question of whose story was it in that indigenous culture.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
And had to do with notions of ownership, not with notions of voice. I think it then became people who weren't white saying, don't pretend that you're me, that mm-hmm. type of thing.
Right. Would you read...
this is a jump. So I'm going to read from the scene where they have cast the play, and a man whose stage name is Snake Eye is playing Antonio, the bad brother. And Anne-Marie is the choreographer and dancer, and Felix is the star of the show. He's the Prospero figure. So they're rehearsing. "We put together a thing," says Snake Eye, "my team, the Antonio team." "Go ahead," says Felix. "You know that place for you, I mean Prospero, you tell the backstory to Miranda about how come, what with the brother, act one, scene two," says Felix. "Yes, that's the one." "What about it?" says Felix. "It's too long," says Snake Eye. "Plus it's boring. Even Miranda finds it boring. She almost goes to sleep." "He's right," thinks Felix. "That scene's been a challenge for every actor who's ever played Prospero. How to get through the act one, scene two narration of Prospero's doleful history while at the same time making it compelling. The thing is too static." "But the audience needs to know the information," he says. "Otherwise they can't follow the plot. They need to hear about the wrongs he suffered and his reason for wanting revenge." "Yeah, we get that," says Snake Eye. "So we thought, why not do it as a flashback?" "It already is a flashback," says Felix. yeah, but you know how you're always saying, show, don't tell, move it, get some energy?" "Yes," says Felix. "And?" "And so, we can do it as a flashback number, only with Antonio telling it. We've been rehearsing." "Huh. He's cutting me out," thinks Felix, "elbowing me aside, making a bigger part for himself. How appropriate for Antonio. But isn't this what he's asked them to do? Rethink, reframe? Great, let's hear it," he says. "The boys are doing backup for me," says Snake Eye. "Team Antonio. We call this evil bro Antonio." "Okay," says Felix, "showtime." "Remember to count," says Anne-Marie as they arrange themselves. "I'm all ears and eyes," says Felix. "Beginning on three," says Anne-Marie. She counts, one, two, three, then claps once and away they go. Snake Eye is aiming for the essence of Antonio, ruthless, full of himself. He puffs himself up, he rubs his hands together, he squints with his slanty left eye, he sneers with his lopsided mouth, If he had a mustache, he'd be twirling it. He prances fit to kill. His team sets the rhythm, stamping, clapping, finger snapping, a cappella, breath work. They're good. They're much better than Felix expected. Is it all due to Anne Marie, or do they get this stuff from music videos? Maybe both. Stamp, stamp, clap. Stamp, stamp, clap. Clap, clap, stamp, stamp, snap. Go the backups. Snake Eye launches in. I'm the man, I'm the Duke, I'm the Duke of Milan. You wanna get pay? Gotta do what I say. Wasn't always this way, no, no. I was once this dude called Antonio. I was no big deal, and it made me feel so bad, so mad. Got under my skin, cause I couldn't ever win. Got no respect, I was second in line. But I just kept smiling, just kept lying. Said everything's fine. It was my bro called Prospero. He was the real man. He was the Duke, he was the Duke, he was the Duke of Milan. Ooh, aha, ooh, aha. Stamp, clap, clap, stamp, snap, snap, stamp. But he was a fool, not cool. He didn't look around, take care of his stuff. Didn't watch his back, stuck his head in a book, said, bro, you know how all of this works, so put on a good show. Say, I say, you're the boss of Milan. They'll do whatever you command. Send him here, send him there, send him far and near. Rake in the loot for me, get a new suit, whatever. He was stuck in his book, doing his magic, waving his wand around and all that shit. I took what I like, and that was fine. Whatever I wanted, it was mine. I got so used to it. But he didn't look, he was slack, didn't watch his back. What a fool, not cool, laid out the temptation. I was bossing around the whole Milan nation. He didn't see what I took. It turned me into a crook, turned me into his evil twin. I went the way of sin, only way I could win. Ooh, aha. Ooh, aha, stamp, clap, clap, stamp, snap, snap, stamp. So I went to the king, the Naples king. He wanted control of that Milan thing. So we made a deal. He'd help me steal it. I'd pay him back. And we grabbed my bro, that Prospero, in the dead of night. We paid off his guards so they didn't put up a fight. We tossed him into a leaky boat. No chance in a million that thing would float. Along with his kid, got rid of her too. Towed them out onto the ocean blue. Told the folks he went away, took a break, took a vacation on a tropical isle. That made him smile, but after a while, when he didn't come back, said he must have drowned. Ooh, aha, ooh, aha. Stamp, clap, clap, stamp, snap, snap, stamp. Oh no, more Prospero. Too bad, how sad, that's what they said. He must be dead. So now I'm the man, the big man. I'm the Duke, I'm the Duke, I'm the Duke of Milan. He's the Duke, he's the Duke, he's the Duke of Milan. Stampity stamp, stampity stamp, stampity stampity stamp. Clap, clap. Ah.
That was Margaret Atwood talking with Doug Stanton. Margaret Atwood's latest books are Hagseed and Angel Catbird. Learn more about the National Writers Series and upcoming events at nationalwritersseries.org and listen to past programs at interlochenpublicradio.org. For Interlochen Public Radio, I'm Linnea Mulcarrick.